Everyone knows the story of Paolo and Francesca, but let me set it down anyway. On a day for dalliance, we read the rhyme of Lancelot, how love had mastered him. We were alone with innocence and dim time. Pause after pause, that high old story drew our eyes together while we blushed and paled. But it was one soft passage overthrew our caution and our hearts. For when we read how her fond smile was kissed by such a lover, he who is one with me alive and dead breathed on my lips the tremor of his kiss. That book and he who wrote it was a pander. That day we read no further.
Writer Robert Hellinga. His new book is The 16 Pleasures, a tale of modern love, Renaissance erotica, and devotion to art. Robert Hellinga will be back in just a moment with more about The 16 Pleasures. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Imagine that you're a young woman skilled in the apparently unremarkable trade of book conservation. Imagine also that it's 1966. Flooding from the Arno River has devastated the Italian city of Florence. Life takes an exciting turn when you have the chance to restore Italian Renaissance books damaged by the flood. What you can't foresee is that soon you'll be at the center of a clandestine plot involving a book unique in the world of Renaissance erotica. Nor do you have any notion about the passionate love affair you're about to embark upon. That's a quick summary of Robert Hellinga's new novel, The 16 Pleasures. Tilly Olson says that the book offers a luxurious feast of pleasures, many more than 16, and reviews in the New Yorker magazine, as well as the Atlantic Monthly and the New York Times, have greeted the book with high praise. Robert Hellinga begins with a reading from The 16 Pleasures.
The little book of pictures wasn't just a valuable piece of property. It wasn't just a unique copy of the most powerful work of erotic art produced by the Renaissance. It wasn't just an occasion to strut my stuff as a conservator. It was the adventure that fate had placed in my path. I couldn't walk away from it any more than Jack could have refrained from exchanging his mother's cow for the magic beans, or Psyche from opening the magic box that Venus had given her to take to the underworld, or Bassanio from accepting the adventure of the three caskets. It was my handful of magic beans. It was my magic ring, my talisman. That's why I couldn't simply sell it to a dealer or turn it over to Sandro. That's why I couldn't give it back to Madre Badesa or turn to Papa for help. It was my story, my story. Without it, I wouldn't know who I was or where I was going. A unique copy, then, of the most famous example of Renaissance erotica. You didn't have to be an expert to realize that this was a valuable piece of property. But not even an expert could have given a trustworthy estimate. There was no way to estimate it, really, since the book had never been sold at auction and therefore had no track record. There was nothing to compare it to.
Bob Hellinga, welcome to the National Humanities Center. What a wonderful book you've written, The 16 Pleasures.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
Tell me, what is a mud angel?
A mud angel was a term used for the student volunteers who flocked to Florence after the flood of 1966. And they were called mud angels because they're the ones who cleaned out the mud from all the basements of the city, one bucket at a time.
Now, this is real. This actually happened.
Absolutely. November 1966.
Uh-huh. And Margot Harrington, now we come to your fictional creation. Margot is, how did you put it to me before our taping? She's sort of a cut above the mud angels?
Well, she brought a lot more expertise to Florence than the mud angels. She was a professional book conservator at the Newberry Library. And so she was not going to be carrying up buckets of mud. She's offering to deal with more sophisticated problems in book restoration.
And what kind of a situation does she find herself in here? She and the Mother Superior, the Mother Abbess of the, let me get this right here, the Santa Catarina Convent, they discover what lurking there in the depths?
Well, as they're dealing with the waterlogged books, a pretty amazing book turns up. It's a unique copy of the sonnets of Pietro Aretino, which were accompanied by 16 drawings, presumably done by Giulio Romano, definitely engraved by Marc Antonio Raimondi. And the Pope had ordered all copies of this book destroyed. It caused such a scandal.
Now, this is a real book that you have inserted into the fictional circumstances of your novel.
This was a real book, and the reason I knew about it was there are lots of jokes about it in English literature. And actually, a copy, no copies exist, but a pirated wood copy of, with woodcuts rather than engravings was discovered by Toscanini's son.
Oh, my goodness.
And sold recently. So you can, in fact, have a look at this. It's published by Northwestern University Press.
Now, we want to use the high-toned word erotica here rather than pornography. What's the distinction?
Well, the appeal is pretty different. Well, actually, in this case, maybe it isn't very different. The drawings themselves, the woodcut drawings that I'd already started the book before this turned up. In fact, I'd pretty well finished it. And I have to say the drawings aren't all that appealing. Now, in my story, I made them tremendously appealing, so it might have been better if they'd never surfaced.
Now, before we hear you read again from The 16 Pleasures, I want you to tell me about Alessandro, who's another one of the lead characters here. Who is this guy?
Well, he's the head restorer of works of art for the region of Tuscany. And Margot runs into him in the Piazza della Signoria, and they have a cup of coffee, and he's the one who suggests that she seek shelter in the convent. In fact, his cousin is the abbess of the convent, the Mother Abbess. And so that's how she gets hooked up there. And then later...
And it's that connection that, in fact, leads her to the discovery of the 16 pleasures.
That's right. And she occasionally turns to him for help in getting supplies that they need. These supplies are, are very hard to come by, Japanese blotting paper and so forth. But he's a man who knows how to arrange things, and everything is possible with him.
Tell me about the abbess and the bishop. There is a political tension here, and this also goes to the 16 pleasures.
Well, the bishop wants more control, and one of his projects is to have the convent library handed over to the monks at San Marco. And the sisters at the convent are resisting this mightily. So the discovery of this book, which everyone knows is going to be a very valuable piece of property, would be an opportunity to help finance the convent library. But technically, the convent does not own the book. The bishop has control over it, and ultimately the Pope would have control over it.
Now, we come after a fashion, Bob Hellingen, to the ethical dilemma that your fictional character Margot has to face when she decides to not only restore this book of erotica, these poems and these drawings, but to put this thing on the black market so that she can help save the convent. Am I right?
Well, absolutely, and that's a big decision for her. The abbess at first asks her to sell the book, but the bishop gets wind of it, and the abbess realizes she can't ask Margot to do this. So Margot decides to do it on her own.
Did you invent this situation, Robert Hellinger, or is there some sort of historical precedent for what you describe in this book?
No, I invented this completely. And in fact, I threw in the, I had been writing this story, and I threw in the book as a sort of private joke, because there's so many jokes about it in English literature. And then after I'd done that, about a week later, I realized that it had the potential to be the engine that drove the book, because it's so valuable financially.
Bob Hellinger, one of the interesting things about your book is that a lot of this story gets told through the voice of a woman. You are a male. Did this present you with any particular, what, perils and rewards creating that voice?
Well, a lot of people have asked about that, and the fact is I wasn't trying to make any kind of statement, political or otherwise. I have three daughters, and I'm very interested in their lives, and they've all gone off to faraway places by themselves. And I think that provided a lot of the emotional impetus for the book. You mm-hmm. have a lot of hopes and fears invested in these trips.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any models in mind, any literary heroes or heroines that passed through your mind as you created this voice of Margot?
The person who influenced me most would have been Gail Godwin. Two of my favorite novels are The Finishing School and Father Melancholy's Daughter. And they're both, like the 16 Pleasures, studies of young women.
Uh-huh. Bob Hellinger, we're talking about your novel, The 16 Pleasures. I'd like you to read another passage here from your book. Tell me what's going on and what we're about to hear.
Well, in this passage, Margot and Sandro have been looking at the erotic drawings, and one thing leads to another, and they make love for the first time. Everyone knows the story of Paolo and Francesca, but let me set it down anyway. On a day for dalliance, we read the rhyme of Lancelot, how love had mastered him. We were alone with innocence and dim time. Pause after pause, that high old story drew our eyes together while we blushed and paled. But it was one soft passage overthrew our caution and our hearts. For when we read how her fond smile was kissed by such a lover, he who is one with me alive and dead breathed on my lips the tremor of his kiss. That book and he who wrote it was a pander. That day we read no further. Well, Sandro and I read no further either. Our go-between was not so high-toned, I suppose, as Paolo and Francesca's French romance, but then ours is not such a high-toned age. But not without its own graces and little courtesies. Sandro led me into the bedroom and undressed me in front of a cheval glass, which is called a psiche in Italian, which is also the word for soul. I had been in love before, but I'd never really experienced lust, at least not like this. All the imperfections with which I was all too familiar of my stocky, serviceable little body seemed to disappear in that glass. I was like a statue coming to life, just breaking out of its rigid pose, and my face was suffused with the kind of radiance, not the kind you try to cover up with powder, either. It was broad daylight, and the figures carved on the frame of the mirror stood out clearly. The judgment of Paris. Aphrodite, Hera, and Athena were all naked as jaybirds. I reached out and touched them with my finger. The wood was smooth and cool. "Which one would you have chosen?" I asked. "Let me see," he said. His face wore a serious expression, as if he were performing some difficult calculations in his head. I was down to bra and panties by this time, wondering which he'd remove first. Aware of his face in the mirror, peering first over one shoulder and then over the other, he had removed his jacket and rolled up his sleeves, like a man about to get down to serious business, but he still had his tie on. "Signorina," he said, "I would choose you." He removed the rest of my clothes, and then I, too, was as naked as a jaybird, as naked as I'd been when I stood on the rock overlooking the sea in Sardinia, ready to take the plunge again.
Bob Hellinger, you have just read to us here from your novel, The 16 Pleasures. We have, what, the continuity and the tension between faith and religion and spirit and flesh? Tell me what's going on in your book.
Well, I wanted to do justice, I think, to both sides of it. And so Margot, in fact, feels the spiritual dimension very strongly. But she's also in the process of discovering her own sensuality, her own sexuality.
Uh-huh.
And I like to think that she does this in a way that, she's falling in love with the world, and the world has so many wonderful things to offer.
Well, she's also drawn to the spiritual nature of the nuns that she basically lives with through much of this book.
Well, one thing that helps, or that I tried to help in this, in reconciling these, is that the Mother Abbess understands both sides of the coin.
Uh-huh. She's a woman of the world who has gone into the convent.
That's right, and she has done so without saying that the world is bad, or without denying the value of these pleasures. And I think this is one of the things that helps Margot. achieve this, because at the end, Margot has these stirrings that suggest she might like to join the convent,
right.
And the Mother Abbess tells her, no, I don't think this is for you.
What about the nature of pleasure? At one level, your novel is a sort of philosophical investigation or treatise. We're talking about food and sexuality, religion, the mysteries, the nature mm-hmm. of art. Man, you've taken on some big orders in this book.
Well, food is easy. I love to to cook, and I like to think about food.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, that's the very first thing I wrote in this novel was about the father doing the cooking.
Right.
And the sexuality speaks for itself, I think. That's the nature of the book. And I think the larger feeling is, and I've already referred to this, the sense of the world has a lot of good things to to offer. And that the enjoyment of that does not necessarily have to be at odds with the spiritual dimension.
Bob, let's change the subject momentarily. Again, your novel is The 16 Pleasures. Tell me about the nature of bookbinding, book restoration. Now, I mean no disrespect when I say, man, this stuff sounds dry as dust, and yet you really put a lot of authentic detail into this.
Well, I've had a lot of good responses to that. I spent a year at the Newberry Library, and while I was there, I took a bookbinding course.
Uh-huh.
And this... I mean, I didn't know how to answer the questions, but at least it gave me the questions to ask, so I knew what I needed to know. And in fact, I went back to the Newberry Library, and a woman in the conservation department there helped me out a lot. She gave me some of her worksheets, and I drew very heavily on that.
Well, now, the kind of thing that Margot Harrington does in restoring books and the bookbinding exercise that she goes through with this book of erotica from the Renaissance, can I stretch the envelope here a little bit? Is this Robert Hellinger telling us about how to compose a life, how to sort of stitch one's life together?
Well, I like that idea. And in fact, her decision to see the Book of Erotic Drawings is originally bound in with a prayer book.
Exactly.
And
talk about polarities.
And when she decides to rebind it herself, which is a pretty major decision, since she really should turn it over to people who are more experienced, she could bind them separately, but she decides to bind them together for a variety of reasons. One, there's some historical justification, and two, she likes the idea of binding the spirit and the flesh together.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a third reason that as a book conservator, it's going to look better because the 16 Pleasures itself would be just a very small pamphlet. So when you bind it in with the other book, it looks better. It's more satisfying aesthetically.
Bob Hellinger, apropos of these comments you're making about bookbinding, I'd like you to read a third passage here from The 16 Pleasures. Margot Harrington is hard at work putting this little book of erotica back together again. What's going on here?
Well, she's taken a pretty big risk by deciding to rebind and restore the book herself. And this passage is set in the workshop of a local bookbinder, and it describes the final steps in this process. I won't say that I did a perfect job, and I won't claim that I Sonetti Lussuriosi put me in a class with Thomas Berthelot or Roger Payne, or with the great modern binders like Douglas Cockerell and Roger de Coverley. But I will say that those curves were enormously satisfying. It was as if Michelangelo had created ex nihilo, a curve as satisfying as some of the curves of the human body. It was gratifying to know that I had added to the small store of these curves. Only one thing went wrong. I had begun to sweat profusely, and as I was about to join the long, flat arc of the last curve to the sharper arc at the end, a drop of sweat fell from my forehead and landed on the hot fillet. The fillet hissed. I jumped as if I had been stung by a bee and overshot the mark slightly. Instead of meeting end to end, the two arcs intersected. I don't suppose the overlap was more than 3 or 4 millimeters, but as far as I was concerned, it was enough to spoil the curve. Have you ever had the impulse, when you're working on something, to destroy it completely if you make even the tiniest little mistake? You hit a wrong note that no one would notice, but instead of going on, you start banging on the keyboard. You write an A instead of an E in copying out a poem, and instead of whiting it out and going on, you crisscross the paper with great big X's. Signor Chaikey must have realized what was going on in my mind, because he reached over and took my hand in his. Niente, he said. It's nothing. No one will notice a thing. When you come back tomorrow, you won't notice it yourself. They say that chess players lose as much as 10 pounds during a match, even though they aren't exercising physically, because they concentrate so hard. That's the way I felt, as if I'd lost 10 pounds. I was drained. I was too tired to redo the first line I'd attempted. Domani, I said. Let's finish up tomorrow. I wiped off the excess gold with a rag dampened with a bit of coconut oil. The tooling was perfect except for the first line, which could easily be retooled, and the one mistake, which stood out like a proverbial sore thumb, or, as the Italians say, a sore nose. But Signor Chaikey was right. The next morning I didn't even notice it, and it wasn't till I was showing the finished book to Sandro a couple of days later that I realized what had happened. Not only had Signor Chaikey picked out the gold where the lines had intersected instead of joining, he dampened the leather, picked up the impression with the point of a pin, and retooled the join. He left his mark, too, in his own way, and I was very grateful.
Bob Hellinga, again, you have just read to us from your novel, The 16 Pleasures. Let's shift gears. Talk to me about Margot, the bookbinder, your lead character here, and what she goes through with her family. I mean, she not only finds a book, she finds herself.
Well, one of the important themes is her family, and this is a very good family. It's not a dysfunctional family. But even so, even though everyone has loved each other and they've all talked to each other, they're driven apart just by the forces of the world. And when she's away, she still thinks of her home as back in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
But then her father has plans of his own, and he buys an avocado ranch in Texas and moves away, and then she really feels stranded. She doesn't know where to what she's supposed to call home.
Well, you keep coming back to that wonderful line from Robert Frost, home is the place where they got to take you in, some words to that effect.
That's right, and that was one of her mother's favorite lines, and she's always thought that she had this home, but now she's not quite sure where she belongs in the world.
One of the struggles that Margot goes through is remembering her mother and sort of talking to her mother over the, what do you want to call it, the chasm of eternity. I mean, the mother is dead at the point when the book takes place. Tell me very quickly about what happened with the mother and the tape recorder. She is going to talk to her family about herself.
Well, her mother makes a series of tapes of things she wants to say to her family. And 3 years after her death, they decide to play the tapes, and they're blank. The tape recorder has malfunctioned.
And what a devastating experience this is for them.
And so Margot is always sort of listening for the sound of her mother's voice. And in fact, at one point in the novel, she gets to hear it. Her mother was an art historian, and when she's looking at the Elgin marbles, she hears her mother, who used to lecture on the Elgin marbles, hears her reading Keats's poem, The Grecian Urn.
Are you preaching to us here, Robert Hellinga, about the saving grace of art rather than the saving capacities of religion?
Well, I've always tried to balance those things. Margot's quite aware that if you'd spoken to her father about the saving grace of art, he wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
That's
so
right.
I always want to undercut that a little, but in fact, there's something like that going on. Although ultimately, she rejects the notion of trying to hang on to things. She says, you've got to let things go. And that the Keats poem might have been a way of hanging on to everything.
Is it fair to say, Bob, that Margot does in fact find herself and comes to terms with herself?
Yes, I think so. Now, in the first version, she was left pretty sad and lonely at the end, and the editor suggested that after she's gone through all this, she really has become the kind of woman her mother would have wanted her to be. And you have to show that in the novel.
And the kind of woman that the mother superior, the mother abbess, wanted her to be.
That's right. So she has gotten the mastery over things and over her life, and she's quite confident of her place in the world.
Uh-huh.
And the original title of the book was Where I Want to Be.
Rather than the 16 pleasures.
That's right. Uh-huh. And at the end, she knows she is where she wants to be.
Bob Hellinger, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What is it really that you are affirming, that you are talking to us about in the 16 pleasures? Religion, art, the flesh, the spirit? You have so many wonderful choices here.
Well, I'm always teetering on the edge of some spiritual affirmation, but I never feel I can quite make it. And I guess what I'm affirming in the character of Margot is that this world has a lot to offer, and that she has found her place in this world the way it is. And there are all these signs around her about pointing to another world or pointing in a spiritual direction, but mm-hmm. she's settling for the world as it is.
Well, after all, the book begins with a disaster of mm-hmm. some sort, and it ends on I wouldn't call it exactly, happy talk note, but it is very affirmative, very optimistic.
Well, she's taken charge of her own life, and as I said before, she's become the sort of woman her mother would have wanted her to be, and she's feeling very confident about herself, and that's as far as I could take the affirmation.
Robert Hellinger's new book, a novel entitled The 16 Pleasures, is available from Soho. Robert Hellinger is a professor of English at Knox College. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was novelist Robert Hellinger of Knox College. Audio cassettes are available for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 742. That's program number 742. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. We'd also like to hear your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, Christianity Through the Ages. Historian Catherine Tackow of the University of Iowa will be here to talk about Christian belief and practice in Europe during the Middle Ages. Theologian Stanley Hauerwas of Duke University will also be on hand to talk about what he calls theological encounters with the secular. He'll also explain why modern American Christians shouldn't read the Bible. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.